very surprised when the news came out locally that it had broken, but that there wasn't any funds to replace it. That was just shocking.
Digital warnings are all very well, but for one town likely to see bushfires this year, there's nothing like a siren. And
just the mere fact that there is a deeply divided and unstable society, it means that it's the conditions are ripe for Beijing to step in and restore order.
Does a chaotic Hong Kong serve the interests of Beijing? Hello and welcome to The Wire, current affairs across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Annie Hastwell in Adelaide. Also today, Indigenous local SA legend Vince Coulthard is recognised for his contribution to media, amongst other things, and robo-debt backflip by the government. What does it mean for people who still think they owe a lot of money? Stay with us for the next half hour on The Wire. Now to the situation with the Hong Kong protests. The occupation of the Polytechnic University seems to be calming down. Police took on a siege against the protesters in the campus and have even been firing with the intent to incapacitate those trying to escape the police force. The Wire's Jack Padley reports.
Protests in Hong Kong have escalated in the past week with serious threats of violence from both protesters and police. Police have seized most of the Polytechnic University, where students have been launching petrol bombs from the roofs as the students have occupied the campus grounds. The raid has entered its fourth day with very few protesters left and some even trying to flee the grounds rather than face the police force. Anthony Dapron has been observing the controversial situation of Hong Kong and its ongoing situation with the protests.
There's a bit of quiet descending over the city, partly because I think protesters are exhausted after the last week of very chaotic, disruptive protests and some violent clashes with police, but also partly because we have district council elections scheduled for this Sunday, and protesters are keen to avoid giving the authorities any excuse to cancel those elections. And so the chaos has calmed down a bit with the hope that those elections will be able to go ahead, elections that many people are thinking will be a referendum on the government in some ways.
So you described in your article on the situation of Hong Kong as, quote, Beijing letting the territory burn. What would you say Beijing is hoping for by letting Hong Kong suffer like this?
In some ways, the ongoing chaos suits Beijing's purposes in two different aspects. Firstly, it's a very helpful propaganda lesson for them to deploy domestically in the rest of China, i.e. they can point to the fairly chaotic images coming out of Hong Kong and say to the rest of China, you know, look, this is what happens to you if you defy Beijing or try to push for democracy. It doesn't have a good outcome. But also, to the extent that there is instability in Hong Kong, that ultimately perhaps plays to Beijing's interests in the medium to long term. They can let the instability carry on. It's not causing any harm to the rest of China. And I think Beijing hopes that eventually either people will be fed up with the chaos and unhappy with the protesters and want to turn back to the government to impose stability. Or just the mere fact that there is a deeply divided and unstable society, it means that it's the conditions are ripe for Beijing to step in and restore order. So I think to some extent Beijing may see this as not necessarily a problem as far as they're concerned.
I've been looking at videos on Twitter on the Polytech University student situation with students with their hands tied in zip ties and their faces in the ground. Would you say the tension in Hong Kong is increasing given these videos and the situation with the students?
Yes, definitely. You know, there's been increasing levels of violence from the police. Last Monday, a bit over a week ago, there was a live streaming video of a police officer shooting an unarmed protester in the stomach. There have been very brutal arrests, footage like the footage that you referred to of those arrests coming out of the Polytechnic University. On Sunday, the police said that if protesters didn't stop throwing Molotov cocktails and using other offensive weaponry against the police felt they would be forced to use live ammunition to storm the university, a prospect that had all of Hong Kong on the edge of their seats, and in fact many thousands out in the streets to seeking to support those protesters holed up at the university. So a great deal of tension, a great deal of outrage at some of the behaviour of the police, and certainly the temperature has been raised significantly by that kind of imagery coming out, yes.
Do you think the damage in Hong Kong, given the protests, is going to be everlasting or even permanent?
There certainly are fears that that is a possible outcome. People have been talking about the Belfastization of Hong Kong. Are we heading in a direction where these these divisions and this level of violence remains permanent or get worse. That's certainly one outcome that no one wants to see, but you couldn't rule it out as an impossible outcome. The other major and possibly permanent change to the city has been the reputation of the city's previously trusted public institutions, such as the police force and the government, and even things like the MTR stations and the MTR operators and the airport authority. So there has been some impact on the level of trust in these public institutions, which may be permanent. The other thing that people are watching very closely is Hong Kong's rule of law and the extent to which the courts or the Department of Justice may be pushed into serving a political agenda. Again, if that happens, that will be something that has a very permanent and long-lasting impact on Hong Kong society. But I think certainly it's been a very turbulent 6 months. There's no end in sight yet, and there is a very strong possibility that in some ways Hong Kong will be permanently changed by what's happened this year.
That's Anthony Dapiran speaking to The Wire's Jack Padley. He's a Hong Kong-based writer and lawyer, and his book City on Fire, The Fight for Hong Kong, is set to release next year. A major overhaul of the robo-debt scheme has been announced this week, removing the central plank of automation that caused thousands of Australians to pay back money they didn't owe to Centrelink. The Minister for Government Services says that only a small cohort of robo-debts are affected by these changes, but the Department of Human Services believe about 600,000 robo-debts will need to be reassessed. So, does the overhaul really make a difference for the victims? The Wire's Annabelle McKinnon spoke to freelance journalist Royce Kermelovs, who's been following the issue, about what the windback means.
The announcement that was made yesterday is a huge symbolic victory for people who have been fighting against this scheme since day one. Essentially what it does is pull the guts out of the system. So the central part of the announcement is that they will no longer be relying purely on income averaging as a means to identify and raise debts against people. Because what the system did, in a nutshell, is compare people's income that they declared to Centrelink against what they declared to the tax office, you know, do a rough kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation, compare the two, and if there was a discrepancy, it sent a debt, all without human oversight, at a rate of about 20,000 debt notices a week. And that began the process of debt recovery. So essentially, by removing that income averaging part of the process, they're essentially backing down on advocating for one of the most egregious aspects of it. As much as this was a hugely symbolic victory for people, a hugely interesting political development, for the people on the ground, it hasn't actually changed much, because for now at least, debts are still being raised, still being identified. The debts will need to be reviewed, people are still paying money, and how that process will play out, what kind of evidence will be involved, the specifics of that, no one's quite sure at this moment. The government just said that they will change it, and they're looking at how they're going to change it.
You don't know if people who have been given robo-debts and are currently dealing with them, will they be affected by these changes at all? Will it help them?
Not immediately, but in the long term, yes, because the government has announced a review. It says that it will be reviewing debts that were identified through this program, that were identified solely using the income averaging algorithm. But, I mean, the minister has said that this only affects, quote, a small cohort. There's a lot of debate about what that means, because it's being read as a way of downplaying the significance of this. The reality is there were thousands of debts issued using income averaging to identify, potential anomalies, which means that the scale of this review could be fairly large and much larger than the department is letting on.
Do you think the government halting the program admits any guilt on their part?
Well, yes, and that's part of the symbolic victory for this, because the government has been advocating for this for the last 3 years, and staunchly it has been denying that there's criticisms and dismissing activists and their observations about what it's like to actually experience beyond the receiving end of the system. And so the fact that the government has backed down from both income averaging and announced a review into these debts is being seen as a capitulation.
What do you think made the government change their mind on this issue?
Sustained pressure. So you got, first off, the pressure from activists and you know, people and academics and people who have been with this from day one, who have made sure that this has stayed live in the media. You have mounting legal actions. So there were two separate legal actions from Victorian Legal Aid that have been filed. First is being heard on 2nd December, and there's a second class action lawsuit happening, which has the potential to set a precedent that says you cannot do this, that this is, you know, fundamentally unlawful. And if it does, the cost of that could potentially be huge.
And just touching back on that class action, do these new changes change anything for what will unfold with that?
No, they announced yesterday will not change the course of these legal actions currently being taken out against the federal government on this issue. These actions are targeted to the legal basis for these debts, and those debts have already been issued and are out there in the world somewhere. People are paying them back as we speak. So, I mean, my understanding is that even if the system is no longer ongoing as it was, these legal actions will still be challenging the original basis on which those debts were raised.
Do you think it's enough to repair the damage of robo-debt?
Well, no. I mean, this has been 3 years of stress, agony and frustration for many people who have gone through an incredibly bureaucratic process and have in many cases either paid money just because they didn't want to have to deal with it anymore or found themselves in a long fight that they didn't have the resources and capacity to be engaged in. Best case scenario for the people, it's lost time. But then we also know that, you know, at least 2,000 people have died after receiving a notice as part of the debt collection process. I mean, that's a huge scandal.
The Wire's Annabelle McKinnon was speaking there to freelance journalist Royce Kermelovs.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
Well, the bushfire threat has moved to South Australia today with hot gale force winds and warnings at catastrophic levels. Wire producer Sarah Martin lives in the hills surrounding Adelaide. Like many hills dwellers, she's already packed her things and moved to the plains for the day. But she says her small hometown of Gumaraka is quite stressed and upset that this fire season they no longer have a warning siren.
When it rings, it's a warning. Initially, the brigade are training every single Tuesday night, you know, 7:30, that's what we hear. Just wails once, it's reassuring, I guess, that it's there. It's annoying, you know, I live 100 metres away from it, but yeah, you know, you get used to it.
And now it's broken.
And now it's gone. So it broke down mid-year, and so it's sort of faded out into the background. But as we're heading into a fire season, we're realising how important it is, and it's sort of feels weird that it's missing.
Now, the fire authorities say, well, you've got messages on your phone. There's all sorts of other ways to get the message around. What makes a siren better than that?
When there was the big bushfire in South Australia, Sampson Flat, for example, that's the only one I've experienced in my town, the fire siren started and it just didn't stop. And that's how you know. Essentially, it's not a test anymore. It's there and it's constant and it's wailing through the town. You can hear it everywhere. So it meant you need to get out. It meant you need to act now. And I did that. I acted now and left with my kids. But for the people who stayed, while it was wailing out, it meant that there was still danger. It was present and it was clear and it was constant. And so I guess it kept people vigilant.
And now you're having to raise money to get a new siren. So clearly sirens aren't high on the agenda of fire authorities these days.
Yeah, I was very surprised when the news came out locally that it had broken but that there wasn't any funds to replace it. That was just shocking. So we have got a fundraiser happening in a week and a half's time that's essentially trying to seek funds from the community. The local CFS put out an inquiry to the community and said, do you think this is needed? And it was a resounding yes. We're now looking to raise the funds from our small 1,000-person community to try and replace this item, which most of us think is essential.
So what do you say to that? Well, everybody has a phone these days. We can just contact you separately and tell you the fire is raging.
Well, I'm a person who doesn't like to be attached to my phone all the time. So, yes, I'll look now because I know there's a fire warning in place. But it's really easy to miss messages. And also I'm concerned that if the electricity runs out and I can't charge my phone after 2 days, what happens? I mean, I'm sure the messages will come through clear. I'm quite savvy. I can work it all out. But I worry for people who perhaps struggle with technology and stuff like that in our community. And also there's a warning message and then there's a next message that says, no, really, really, you need to watch and act and there's something threatening and then there's a get out now or stay. But that permanent reminder that constantly rings through if there's a fire is reassuring. Somebody's watching. Somebody's telling us, that community, what's going on. That's not going to be there. And I just don't quite know how that's going to fill the void.
Wire producer Sarah Martin worrying about the lack of an old-fashioned fire siren in her town as the fire season ramps up. David Bowman is Professor of Pyrogeography and Fire Science at the University of Tasmania. I asked him whether digital warnings were really enough.
Frankly, we absolutely have to deploy every technique possible, because the most dangerous time in a bushfire disaster is the decisions people make as the fire is approaching. And if people haven't got out early or haven't prepared their properties to withstand the onslaught of a fire, and they're in the, wavering between staying or leaving, or, you know, they're all muddled, that's when people die. And that's something we really want to avoid, you know, people fleeing. People should not be driving through burning landscapes. They should not be driving through ember storms. And so these warnings are really important to help people get their focus together and plan for the decisions, that, which really may be a life and death decision.
There's been a lot of talk this week about preparedness for fire and how well-resourced it is. Is it fair that a small town should have to do a fundraiser to restore their siren, their broken siren?
So, look, there's a really big conversation that as a society we're going to have about sharing the cost burden for fire preparedness. We need the pushing out every possible tool available to help people prepare for fire danger and to help people prepare their properties, help people retrofit their properties, insure their properties and make fire safe communities. That's a political conversation that's got to be had with state government and also local council level of how you can get those outcomes. And if a community feels the siren's important, then it's alarming that, you know, if it's obsolete and it needs replacing, it's alarming that, you know, they're struggling to get it replaced. That's really sad, and we need to do better than that.
David Bowman, Professor of Pyrogeography and Fire Science at the University of Tasmania. And we were planning to take up the issue of who pays for sirens or whether sirens are still in the mix with the community fire, with the fire services, but obviously today in South Australia is not a good day. They're all on alert. Adnumatna elder Vince Coulthard thought he was going out to celebrate a new work appointment for his daughter last week, but later realised the event was to honour him. 150 people travelled to Ikara, the Wilpena resort in Flinders Ranges in South Australia recently, to celebrate Vince's 45 years of work serving Indigenous Australians. He's a traditional owner of the Flinders Ranges and director of South Australia's only Aboriginal radio station, the Umuwara Aboriginal Media Association in Port Augusta. The Wire's Catherine Andrews asked him today what his reaction was when he found out the event was for him.
It did come as a shock to me. I was the impression that it was to honour a young person becoming the 2IC, or second in charge of the Ikara Wilpena Resort. So it did come as a real surprise to me.
How does it feel to have been honoured in this way for your contributions to the Indigenous Australian community?
I'm just like everybody else. There's a whole bunch of people that they're doing their bit to improve our standing in our community. I'm just another one of many people who are trying to make a difference. I should say I was fortunate in being able to grow up in an environment where being mentored by my elders, getting the information, and I'm able to use some of that information in today's dealings with the government and other agencies. So I'm one of those fortunate people that are able to utilise the skills and the information that their elders have given me.
Some of your achievements include being a ranger and dedicating half a century to Indigenous media. When you look back on your life achievements, which one are you the most proud of?
My time in working as a ranger in the National Parks and Wildlife Service, they were good. I mean, we were dealing with trying to bring about the recognition of traditional land management techniques and skills to the department, which was pretty set in its own ways, I guess, and they believe that they got the best management practices for the environment of Australia. So it was a very difficult task, and
in educating the the Parks and Wildlife Service in recognising traditional land management. In the media, that all come about because for many, many years, we were getting a lot of bad publicity, I should say, through the mainstream media. And that's one of the reasons why the First Nations media was created, to be able to get the other side of the story. I mean, today, it's still happening that, you know, the stories aren't really told by mainstream media the way they should be. But we also, a very important part of our media stream is to be able to educate, bring about some understanding and education to our non-Aboriginal listeners.
Why is it so important for Aboriginal voices to be heard in the media?
Well, our people have been here for many thousands of years. You know, we're the first Australians, so shouldn't we have our voice be heard too, along with everyone else? Shouldn't our concerns be put out there in the media? When we got concerns, shouldn't we be able to hear them some way? I mean, it happens for every other Australians, you know, other people around the world. So we can't get that from mainstream media. Well, we have to do that from our First Nations media. So, I mean, you know, our voice need to be heard. And Australia will always, has always been, and will always be Aboriginal land.
You are a part of South Australia's first native title claim. What more needs to be done in regards to Indigenous native title rights across Australia?
Indigenous native title rights, or First Nations people's native title rights, has been recognised. The big step is to get sovereign rights, sovereignty. I mean, that's something that we've fought long battles since the Native Title Act was handed down and the case was handed down from Mabo back in 94. I mean, there's been lots of progress since then in terms of recognising native title rights, but now is the big battle in getting sovereign rights and maybe developing treaties across the nation.
Vince Coulthard, traditional owner of the Flinders Ranges, speaking with The Wire's Catherine Andrews. Well, in September 2016, South Australian residents were left without power when violent storms caused the state's power grid to fail, and much of the blame was pointed at the state's use of renewable energy. When Tesla's Elon Musk stepped in, promising to build a large battery, it was ridiculed by many. It's actually been a huge success and is now set to be expanded. The Wire's Michaela Komarek talked to Sarah Hanson-Young about the development.
It has worked, it's working extremely well, and so much so that it's now going to be expanded, which is fantastic. And moving to 100% renewables is what this country needs to do. South Australia is well and truly on our way, and storage, particularly battery storage, is a big part of that.
Can you explain what difference a battery has made to South Australia's energy situation so far?
Look, it's made a significant impact in two key areas. Firstly, being able to have such a large storage capacity is really important, because when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, you need to be able to bank that. Make hay while the sun shines and bank it. And the batteries allow us to do that. When the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing, that we can actually tap in and use that stored power. But the other thing that the battery has been able to do is provide very, very fast response to transition our energy network and our energy production to 100% renewables, to make it cleaner, to get away from fossil fuels. You need clean energy, such as wind and solar. You need storage capacity, but you also need smart management and demand management.
What will the expansion of the battery provide to further success?
Well, what this will be able to do is to allow for the continued expansion of more and more renewables across the state. We've also, of course, in the process of hoping to build an interconnector from South Australia through to New South Wales. With this big battery being expanded, with more investment in renewables in SA, we will hope that we can export clean power across the border. The only way we're going to deal with damaging and very dangerous global warming is to reduce the carbon pollution that Australia currently has, and that means we need to increase the clean energy production. To do that, we need to invest clean energy and renewables where they are and be able to power them into the grid and to send it out of our state.
And energy prices are a big problem. What will the expansion mean for energy prices?
Well, one of the best things about the expansion of the battery and what this battery has already been able to deliver is because it provides stability in the grid and certainty, it has enabled more investment in renewables, which drives power bills down. The thing that has in the past driven power bills so high in South Australia is the ability for the big fossil fuel powered power companies, particularly gas, to game the system when there's...
That's South Australian Senator Sarah Hanson-Young talking to The Wire's Michaela Komarek. And that's it for today's Wire. Join us tomorrow, same time, on your local station. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Annie Hastwell. Thanks for your company.
You're so beautiful.